I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, hello, and welcome, or should I say welcome back, to the Indie Football Podcast. I am Ed Malley, and as ever, sports editor of The Independent, and alongside me, I have three of three of the most talented sports writers on the planet. Yeah, okay. To my right, Luke Brown.
Hello.
Opposite me, but with a slightly dodgy microphone by all accounts, Lawrence Osler.
Hello.
Project louder.
I'm trying.
Thank you very much. And to my left, Jack Pitbrook.
Hi, Ed. How you doing?
I am okay. It is Monday, which means we've had a full weekend of Premier League football, minus one game, Crystal Palace versus Liverpool tonight, which Crystal Palace will draw 2-2, Wilfried Zaha and Aaron Wan-Bissaka scoring to level out Naby Keita's goal and then Sadio Mane's incredible strike. So let's look back at the weekend's activities between you. Jack, you were not at a game this weekend.
Oh,
you're going to catch Liverpool tonight.
I was actually at Bath City 2, Dulwich Hamlet 1 in the Conference
South. Of course.
Disappointing result for the Hamlet.
Yeah, it's particularly bad when, given that Dulwich scored after 5 minutes and I arrived after 10 minutes because my Uber driver didn't know exactly how to get there. and so I missed Dulwich's goal and then kind of played okay for the rest of the first half. Then second half, Bath came into it a lot more. Deserved the 2-1 win. Frustrating away day.
Is Bath the biggest city in England without a Football League team?
That's a really good question.
Thank you very much.
I don't know.
York in League 2, yeah. Aren't they? York in League 2?
Yeah, maybe.
It just strikes me. I mean, Bath is a tremendously... It doesn't strike you as a football town in any way, shape or form, does it? It's a very lovely little city, but I'm not sure you'd ever expect a big football team to come out there, especially when Bristol have got two. What was your impression of Bath City and their small ground?
Well, the most interesting thing about Bath City is that one of the biggest figures in Manchester City history, Tony Book, the captain of the team that won the league in 68, the cup in 69, the cup winners' cup in 1970, he started off in non-league for Bath City, played for Bath for years, before moving to Plymouth Argyle in his late 20s, and then to Manchester City at the age of about 30, before going on to captain City with great success in the late 60s and early 70s, and then managing City in the late 70s himself. It's amazing, really. I was having this conversation with my dad the other day. Can you think of other examples of player who, I mean, I guess Jamie Vardy's probably an equivalent, in the sense that he has had sustained success towards the top end of the English game after a long time in non-league. But even then, he wasn't in non-league for as long as Tony Book was.
And also, I guess, at that point, the non-league was probably a lot lower quality than it is now. I mean, like when you look at some of the teams in non-league,
the gap
was
probably less big between the non-league and the First Division in the 1960s than between the non-league and the Premier League today.
Yeah, for sure. And that's the book on Tony Book. Tony Book?
Tony Book.
I can confirm that York are not in the Football League and does have a bigger population than Bath.
Well, that's why Lawrence is on the podcast today. Well, actually, it's not. There are two reasons why.
That would be a really good pub quiz question.
What?
Not
the,
anymore,
the city?
Because we've spoiled it.
Well, no, yeah, but I know, but we only have around 500,000 listeners every week, so the rest of the country wouldn't know. As I say, Lawrence is on here for three reasons. One, devilishly handsome. Two, the sort of Wikipedia skills that you can only dream of. And three, he was at Brighton versus Manchester United yesterday, where, and I know we've used the phrase Jose Mourinho season in every single episode so far this season, much to Jack Pitbrook's delight, but we're going to have to use it again. Lawrence, after seeing it up close, are we in the midst of another Jose Mourinho season?
It did feel that way, yeah. I think... you can put it in perspective of it's the second game of the season and maybe the very generous caveats of Matic and Herrera to come back in the team and steal up the midfield a little bit. Lukaku's first start back after the World Cup, he looked a bit rusty, missed a one-on-one early on in the game, which could have changed the complexion of the match a little bit. But I think those are like the most generous things you can say. It really did feel like perhaps the beginning of a pretty cataclysmic season.
My main takeaways, I did watch all of this. It wasn't just the result. It wasn't just the scoreline. When Brighton fans are singing "We Want Four" in the first half of a game against Manchester United, you're in trouble for a start. But even at 3-1, then 3-2, with the late penalty, so it was basically 3-1 the entire second half. Manchester United did so many things that were utterly stupid. So many things that made you think, like, this team is, like, all over the place. And I'm talking, there's one point where I think maybe the left-back just, like, hoovers a 20-yard, 30-yard crossfield ball to one of the centre-backs, miscontrols it, kind of gets in a scrap. They actually get away with it. Yeah. I think Ashley Young scrambles the ball away. But when you keep doing utterly stupid things like that, that put you in bad positions constantly, that is when, like, you start questioning what the hell's going on. Because the team, obviously, I mean, that you just watch them. It's a team bereft of confidence. There's one bit where Lukaku tries to kind of control the ball by the sideline, and he almost, like, I don't know, just kind of backheel punts it out into the benches and stuff.
Yeah.
There are so many stupid things, so many really just bad-looking things, ugly things, that do start to chime with the fact. And then you see Jose after the game, and he is who he is, and it's cantankerous and whatever. But it was the little things that I saw that they actually got away with which made me more worried about Manchester United than anything else. Jack, did you see this one?
Yeah, I did watch it. I thought it was probably overall the worst United performance under Mourinho. I can't think of anything
People
else.
Have said the worst post-Fergie, but I think there were probably more painful nadirs under Moyes.
Yeah, wouldn't go that far.
In terms of, like you're right, it was both like collective failure but also specific individual errors. It did. I mean, it's easy to make these comparisons, but nevertheless, it did have lots of the hallmarks of the classic kind of autumn 2015 Mourinho season, like the crumbling defensive structure, the surprising decisions in terms of the starting lineup, like starting Pereira and Martial, which you kind of get the impression are just done for effect, like they're done to kind of spark a reaction, which didn't happen. The lack of confidence on the ball in the second half, the lack of kind of coherent team play, the absence of any idea of how to get back into the game, and this kind of weird freeze you had in the second half. We have all these top players who've got either no idea or no desire to turn the game around.
Or both, I think. Lawrence, you were saying the back four were bad, and I think that was the thing watching them is just the back four was a mess, but you said the front three were arguably worse.
Yeah, and Jack touched on it there, the kind of lack of cohesion in the team. And that I really sensed from the front three. I mean, Juan Mata, if he plays in a front three, you want him to come short because he hasn't got the pace to run in behind. But he didn't really do that either. So he was anonymous for 45 minutes. Martial was out on the touchline, not really getting involved. Lukaku was really quiet. But then what was, I think, most startling for me was that Mourinho changed it at halftime. So he brings on Jesse Lingard and Rashford, who brought on lots of energy, but just didn't change the game, didn't bring invention. They didn't. And Mourinho's changes. Then he did his classic on the hour, brought on Fellaini, and it was like just his stock book of like classic changes to try and shift it, and none of them worked. And that was almost the most concerning thing, was that he identified problems but couldn't solve them.
I think Mourinho gets into the cycle, and I think this is another similarity with 2015-16, is that things won't go right, and then his like stock response to that is a sort of a grand gesture which he thinks will spark a response, whether it's dropping a top player or, you know, criticizing someone in a press conference or shouting at the club doctor or whatever. But that's basically the dynamic. And clearly, like, none of the nothing he did this time worked. And so I wonder, for their next game, they've got Tottenham on Monday night. I imagine there will be some grand gesture in the build up to that game, whether it's dropping Pogba.
What do you reckon it is? Bring in like a kid or something?
Yeah, like dropping Pogba or dropping Lukaku or dropping De Gea. If you look back to 2015-16, he like literally every Chelsea first team player, with the exception of Ivanovic, got dropped or called out in the media or both by Mourinho. And I imagine, I might be wrong, but my guess is that he will go through the same cycle at United now. Every single top player will get hammered, not because they've done anything wrong, but just for effect.
The interesting thing was, so in May, United lost to Brighton 1-0, if you remember, at the Amex as well. And after the game, Mourinho indirectly slammed Rashford and Martial, I think it was. He said, this is why you ask why I don't start Lukaku. This is why, because these players aren't good enough, essentially. This time, he recoiled, almost didn't want to say anything afterwards, and just sort of avoid the questions. So it's like he's taken a slightly different tack, but you feel like, yeah, that reaction is just bubbling away and is going to come out this
week. Well, he blamed individual errors, which is always an interesting one, because that absolves him immediately of any responsibility, which obviously is his favourite thing of doing. I thought that the fact that, like Jack said, you're always looking for which part of the playbook he's going to reach for, and I was intrigued to see what he was going to say when he came out. You know, sometimes the manager will go for, we just weren't good enough. Or, I think you should talk about how good Brighton were. Like, everyone's going to talk about how bad Manchester United were, but how good were Brighton today, or whatever. Or he says, actually, I thought we were really good today. We just, like, everything went against us. You know, there's so many different things we've heard him say. For him to just go for the individual errors sort of thing, like, yeah, I mean, there's no obvious academy kid he can just, like, throw in there to try and shake things up, you know?
He already has, isn't he? Because he threw in McTominay last year and then
Right,
Pereira
I know, but
year.
if that's your joker, Scott McTominay.
In Mourinho's defence, I mean, I'm not a Mourinho apologist, but in Mourinho's defence...
Luke is the Mourinho apologist, so let's all sit down here and pick your coffee up and have a little think what the Mourinho apologist is going to say.
The individual performances, in particular in this game, were, like, especially at the back, were so poor.
Big Eric had a bit of a...
I mean, he was just atrocious. Lindelof was incredibly bad. Fred just made, like, so many kind of inexplicable decisions and kind of wasn't effective in going forward or going back or doing anything. And just, like, those kind of performances, I'm not sure whether they can kind of be attributed to Mourinho. I mean, obviously there's, like, structural failures, and going forward, I think you can probably blame him a lot more. But those errors at the back where they're just so routine and so basic.
It's an interesting one, isn't it, this debate? Because, like, on a granular level, an individual error is the fault of the individual. But when every player is making individual errors, then you have to look at the context. And I think that ultimately, again, to draw yet another parallel with 2015-16, when all the individuals are making individual errors, it's because there's something fundamental is wrong.
And that is why Jack Pitbrook is here, because that is the exact problem. That's it. What it comes down to is...
Fred maybe gets a pass because he's only just arrived from Shakhtar, but even then, I mean, he's not exactly Fernandinho, is
Manchester
he?
United, Manchester United...
He kicked Luke Shaw in the face.
Right, Manchester United would be better with blank number of the other Premier League managers. Would Manchester United be better with Chris Hughton in charge?
Great question. Yes.
Would Manchester United be better with Roy Hodgson in charge?
For context, within this specific season.
Yes.
Not like on a sort of.
I'm saying if you gave these players for that game against Brighton, if you'd said, actually, you know, we've swung the axe on Jose. Here's Roy.
Yeah, I'd say that. I think I'm going to go with yes on this. I think that United.
How many managers in the Premier League wouldn't be better than Jose?
Like, Hughton and Hodgson might not lead to a revolution in style of play, but they would lead to a big change in atmosphere. And I think a lot of the players might start to think, it'd be a bit like when Hiddink comes in every few years at Chelsea at Christmas. The players might think, well, actually, I might not want to play for this guy for the next five seasons, but equally, I know that if I play well this season, then... You know, I might get a new contract and I'll be playing the Champions League next year for, I don't know, Simeone or Pochettino or another more exciting manager. In that context, yes, I agree with you. I think that lots of those managers would improve Manchester United on the kind of single season term.
Do you think it's already broken?
I think it's breaking to a point where it can't be fixed.
You said last week that you think they should be planning for a new manager for next season. Who do you think they should start trying to... how do I say this without getting us in legal trouble? Who do you think they should start becoming friendly with?
I think Pochettino. I mean, I know he signed a new contract this year, and he would probably cost, like... more than any manager has ever cost in compensation.
I don't even think it'd be close. I think this would be a completely game-changing amount of money. I think you're looking at 50 million plus.
A friend of mine texted me the other day saying, do you think Ed Woodward should offer Levy 20 million for Pochettino? And I thought, well, he wouldn't even text him back for 20 million.
do you think Levy would even do it? I'm not even sure Levy would even...
I think he would only do it if he were given...
Poch would have to ask,
hypothetically, I think Levy would only say yes if he were given no option whatsoever by Pochettino.
Right.
But I mean, honestly, I don't know enough about like the legal, like the legal situation in those cases, like how it free also Pochettino
it
would be.
It
to
takes
work
into
out.
Account how much money's on his contract and stuff like that. That's your starting point.
I suppose the next question would be interesting: is if Ed Woodward can pick any manager like Pochettino, do we think that would solve the problems at Man United, or is it even beyond the manager? Is it even above that?
Well, you'd hope by that point they would have this director of football that they've begun the process of finding, I guess. It just interests me. I mean, Pochettino does seem the most obvious one for like everyone keeps saying that. Like for me, I think Diego Simeone is probably the second best coach in the world.
Is he gettable?
No, probably not, but there's only one way to find out.
Yeah.
And at least now, if you start it, then he can start learning English and you can start getting the intorno, like the all the people around him on side and prepared for the fact that, you know, this is their last season at Atletico, is going to be their best chance at winning silverware for a while. So, you know, that's who I would go for. That's what I would do.
That would be an amazing thing to see.
It'd be incredible for the Premier League. As I say, it's incredibly unlikely because Simeone is so difficult to get out of Atletico. As you've seen by the way, he's been able to keep players there. Like, it's just an incredibly unlikely thing. But if my belief is that if you think this Mourinho situation is broken, and watching them yesterday, I don't really see how a proper recovery ever comes. Like, maybe they don't finish top four. I think that they've got too many good players to not finish top four. But if they don't, then it's something we just start looking at. And we haven't mentioned yet the team that actually beat them. So Lawrence can just give me a line or two on Brighton.
Yeah, and we should do, because they played really well. They're completely different from last week. I think this is the interesting thing that Houghton said afterwards, which was that like he was praising of his team, but then he quickly said, we need to make sure that we don't raise our game just for Man United. And away to Watford, they were probably the worst team on the opening weekend of the season. They lost 2-0 to Watford. And you could argue they were the best team in this weekend. So that is obviously promising, but I think it's a sign that, again, most of their points are going to come at home. I think they're the worst away record of any team last season, even worse than West Brom. So they're going to be really reliant on home. But on the basis of this game, the atmosphere was amazing. And yeah, they played really well. So they played like a quality Premier League team.
We haven't seen a lot of their interesting new signings either. Once those, like Alireza Yakhanbash, well, I think once those guys are in the team, Florian Andone, we're going to see different stuff. I thought, having watched a lot of Glenn Murray over the years, Glenn Murray is the worst possible centre forward that Man United could have played this weekend. And I mean, of probably any centre forward in the league, you'd rather play against Sergio Aguero than Glenn Murray when your centre backs are inexperienced, short of confidence, yeah, and have a mistake in them. And Glenn did exactly what we thought. You know, the first goal is classic him. It's the near post run, delicate finish. He must be, he's like 32, 33 now.
I think older.
He hasn't got the pace to lose. You know, he's just a smart player and really good guy to have around. And I think Steve Parrish admitted that that's the one player like he regrets letting go. I think Pardew thought that Glenn was done. And, you know, yesterday was a vintage lone striker performance, like just holding up the ball, doing everything you need to do, just occupying the defenders.
Well, the centre-backs walked past after the game. Eric Bailly and Victor Lindelof walked past me. And I was surprised that like, neither of them seemed very big. And Glenn Murray, I think he just bullied them. He was just physically stronger than them, and then had the movement as well to score that goal.
I mean, this is the biggest game in Brighton, because I think there's probably more Man United fans in Brighton than there are Brighton fans as well. So it's like, you know, it's a big thing for them. You know, the ones that cross the divide on both clubs
really
obviously get their day.
Huh? That's a really good dig.
No, I mean, it's literally true. I've been to Brighton before where someone's wearing a Brighton shirt with a Liverpool backpack. It's just one of the most bizarre things I've ever seen. But you've got to remember, like, they're selling out like a 28,000 seat stadium now, and when they're at the Withdean and stuff, and the fans that have been with them through, that's what I actually thought yesterday. You know, the thing I said about when they're chanting "We want four" in the first half against Man United, the few fans that survived the Goldstone Ground and the Withdean, for them that is the most beautiful thing ever. You've been through absolute hell to get to the point where you're singing "We want four" against Man United in the first half, which is like unthinkable for any Brighton fan in the 90s. But obviously, like at least 20,000 of the people there weren't. So, yeah. Well done to Brighton. The other big game of the weekend was at Stamford Bridge, and a bit of a humdinger by all accounts. Luke Brown, you were there.
It was a great game. It was a really strange game as well, because for 20 minutes at the beginning, Chelsea were incredible, just absolutely fantastic. And I think what was most encouraging is that they resembled the Napoli side that Sarri managed last year. Jorginho, the way Jorginho slotted in, and it's not even the way he kind of moves the ball around. It's the way he's orchestrating the press, pointing out to his, you watch him, he's actually pointing to all of his teammates where they should be. So he's been a fantastic signing.
Well, perhaps that's why he was so important for Sarri, that they got him.
Yeah.
Manchester, I think, was it Liam, Liam Toomey, who covers Chelsea for ESPN and has worked for The Independent before and stuff. He said the other day, the whole Premier League should be thanking Chelsea for making sure Man City didn't get Jorginho. Because if Man City definitely had signed him, it would be Curtis.
Although, at the minute, I think he's more effective at Chelsea because he's just slotted into a kind of ready-made system that is orchestrated around his strengths. And, you know, Sarri has had an incredible piece of luck. Not many new managers get to go to a club and kind of just take along their best player from the previous season and the previous club. So, Chelsea were brilliant. But what was strange is that after the game, Sarri kind of made a comment that there was only a kind of 15-minute window that he felt Chelsea weren't playing at their best. For many, it looked like kind of Chelsea started brilliantly, then Arsenal got back into it, and then the second half was, you know, kind of relatively open, and Chelsea weren't quite as good, but obviously they got the winner late on. But, Chelsea were very good, and I think there's signs of encouragement for Arsenal, even though obviously it's another defeat. It's now two losses in a row for Emery, but even though they kind of were blown away in those opening 20 minutes, they still created chances, and the fact that players like Aubameyang are missing complete sitters, usually you'd kind of back those players to score. So I think that against maybe teams that aren't quite as strong, they will do well. I think they should beat West Ham comfortably on Saturday. But yeah, Emery's still waiting.
Are you more bullish about Chelsea's chance in the Premier League than Arsenal's based on that game?
Yes, although I think obviously the defensive problems for Chelsea, I mean, at the down out wide, they were just getting absolutely torn to pieces. Marcus Alonso, as brilliant as he is, and despite the fact he scored a winning goal, is not a fullback.
Like, well,
that's evidently clear.
He can't play on. Do we not think he can play on the left of a back four?
Not sure.
I think against maybe teams that are going to kind of sit back and look to contain Chelsea, I think fine. But whenever kind of obviously Bellerin was just getting into the space behind him again and again and again, and you know, it's Arsenal should have scored four goals in the first half. That's not an exaggeration.
Do you think David Luiz can play in a four?
Again,
that's a big talking
I
point.
Think maybe you can afford.
Conte thought he could play in a three.
Conte thought he couldn't play in a
four. But then he ditched him. I mean, he ditched him back end of last season.
I think he only went to the three in part in the first season because he thought Luiz could only work in the three, but he never.
I think maybe you can afford like one of Luiz or Alonso in a kind of back four. But when you've got both and Rudiger's not. Rudiger wasn't amazing. Thing is, though, with Jorginho slotting in between the two centre-backs, it makes sense to have two powerful defenders. Obviously, Rudiger and Luiz are both big lads. They can both kind of do a job from defending corners and stuff. And that's the one question about Jorginho is that off the ball, he is very weak. And in that system, he's got an awful lot of defensive responsibility as well. When Arsenal got the better of the game, it was because they got to grips in midfield and they were just shoving Jorginho and Kante off the ball at kind of every opportunity and then just spreading it out wide. So I think there are question marks for Chelsea. But, you know, Sarri turned up and he said he wanted to, you know, deliver fun and excitement. And, he, you know, that's something clearly he's doing. His teams are incredibly attacking. They're fun to watch. So
What makes... I like Marcus Alonso a lot. I think he's an incredibly talented player. He's obviously technically incredibly talented in terms of, like, you've seen his free kicks and his set-piece delivery is very good. If you decide, for whatever reason, that you can't play on the left of a back four, what they would do in Spain or South America in this system is put him on the left of that midfield three as someone who gets up and down because then he's got cover behind him and you still get the best bits out of him.
But who do you exclude? Because you've got to play Kante.
Precisely.
So.
The problem is Chelsea got so many bloody midfielders because you could play Kante, you know, if Jorginho is the central guy in that midfield three, you could put Kante on the kind of the right, what they call a carrilero in Spain, which is just a guy who gets up and down. So you've got Kante, who's just covering ground, a huge, immense amount of ground on the right of that. Then on the left, instead of Kovacic or Loftus-Cheek or Barkley or Drinkwater, you could play Marcos Alonso, and I think it wouldn't be a bad position for him. Unfortunately, they've just got so many players there. It doesn't seem likely. So where does Marcos Alonso play? If he really can't fit in as a left-back on the back four, there's no position for him under this coach. Someone else might get an absolute bargain. It wouldn't surprise me if Real Madrid came in for him late because they want a left-back, and he's clearly good, and you don't have to do much defending as a Real Madrid left-back.
Yeah, Marcelo showed. Also, it's interesting you touch on Kovacic because he came off the bench, and obviously it was Eden Hazard who kind of turned the game around, but Kovacic was incredibly tidy. There was a stat floating around where he didn't misplace a single pass, and most of those were in the kind of opposition half as well. So he looked good. But, you know, without getting too kind of Brexit gammon about it, it's a bit of a shame for Ross Barkley because he obviously had a really promising game, was taken off, and then you're kind of looking at that team like, how the hell does he really get back into that?
Do you think eventually the midfield three will be Kante, Jorginho, Kovacic, with neither Barkley nor Loftus-Cheek in the
side? That looks like their first choice.
I think
midfield
and
three.
Barkley will be the man kind of in contention. I
mean, Barkley looks like, to be fair to him, you know, there were people wondering where his career was going, but he's in, at least in Sarri's mind, I think.
Yeah, you can see why Sarri likes him as well, the kind of way he's reinvented him.
Drinkwater and Loftus-Cheek are the ones I worry about, particularly Loftus-Cheek, because Loftus-Cheek has shown so much over the past 12 months that if he's not going to get first-team football, if he does go somewhere on loan in the next 3 weeks, goes somewhere foreign.
Vitesse Arnhem, something like that.
Well, Schalke have been linked. I mean, I don't know if...
Schalke have been linked to everyone,
haven't they? I think there are Premier League clubs who now would love to have him in January. In fact, I can tell you at least two. But do you want him to go on loan to the Bundesliga for another year? Like, I don't know. This whole thing, I think Chelsea have managed it badly. I think their squad is obviously impressive, but it's just got like it's got a weird composition. You've got so many central midfielders, as we said, and then in other positions you're actually a little bit short. So Azpilicueta is going to be the right back all season, we think.
Yeah, and Just on Loftus-Cheek as well, I don't think Sarri's particularly bothered. I mean,
no, he's not.
In the presser afterwards, you know, everyone's fishing, kind of, is he going to stay at the club? Is he going to go out on loan? And Sarri gave this weird, long-winded answer on kind of the complexion of his bench and why Loftus-Cheek wasn't quite yet ready for a place on the bench.
That's
well,
a no. It's a no.
Yeah.
What are we thinking on... I did the preview for this game and it was kind of an interesting one because it was two footballing projects that are in their early stages. We don't know what to expect. It's kind of a freebie for both, you know, like whoever wins it gets 3 points against a potential top six rival, even though you know that you haven't fully clicked yet. So it's great. Whoever loses, it's a bit of a kick in the teeth, but you're going to get a free pass from the fans because it's so early on. So yeah. Unai Emery's point of view, how do you think he sees this one?
I think it was, using that logic, I think it was more important for Chelsea to win because even though they're both projects in their early stages, Chelsea squad are used to new managers coming in with new philosophies. Plus, I think that Sarri philosophy is maybe easier to kind of transfer to from the way Conte was setting that team up. Emery is trying to do something completely different. Myself and Jack, we were both at the Arsenal City game and Arsenal were playing out from the back and it wasn't the first phase, it was the second phase. They'd get the ball to the defenders and then they didn't really know what to do with it. They'd quite often just ping it straight back to Cech and it was all a bit clumsy and that kind of happened again against Chelsea. When they were getting some success, it was mostly because of Chelsea's own deficiencies and it was out wide. It wasn't really because they were kind of building play up really nicely. And
although the Iwobi goal was an example of a flowing move from the back.
It was, but it all started because, I can't remember, Willian, I think it was, wasn't it, got robbed. So I think with Arsenal, it's going to take longer than it will with Chelsea. But, you know, two games, I didn't think Arsenal were particularly bad against City. They were better against Chelsea. And I think they'll be looking at a game on Saturday. Saturday's a huge game for them now because obviously they're going up against a winless West Ham. So I think they should win that one. And there's reasons to be encouraged.
And you're going to be at that relegation 6-pointer between Arsenal and West Ham this weekend.
Exactly. Who's going to go down? It's the big one.
So we're starting to see something of Arsenal. We're starting to see something of Chelsea and Chelsea get the points. Tottenham beat Fulham 3-1 this weekend. Tottenham kind of needed that. Harry Kane getting a goal in August, which last year was some sort of storyline, Jack, I seem to remember. Lucas Moura, you know, interesting to see him starting games and getting on the score sheet in the first half. Fulham have lost two in a row. That's one of the teams that we were kind of excited about. Alan Smith did something in the Times today about how the teams that have gone with continuity have started the season much better than those who have thrown new signings in. Fulham, I believe, threw 6 in against Palace and then 7 at Wembley on Saturday. Are we still confident in Fulham?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think it's inevitable that when you make that many changes at the start of a season, particularly like combined with the effect of being promoted into a new division, like it's obviously going to take them, I don't know, 4 or 5 games to get there, to get together. So I wouldn't be too worried about Fulham. I think they do have the quality and the good manager to make things work. Like it's probably better to buy too many good players than too few. even if it means that you have to kind of get most of your points in the second half of the season.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
And the interesting thing from Spurs is the reintegration of Toby Alderweireld into the team, which isn't something I was actually expecting to happen, but means they can go back to the back three last seen.
We think there's no chance that in the first half one of the Spanish clubs comes in for him now.
No, I can't see him telling him
and, and Bayern Munich have denied an interest.
No. So they can go back to the back three from the first half of last season, which with which they played some really good football, and it means they don't have to play Moussa Sissoko in midfield. So it's a kind of win-win-win for Spurs, and they look really good.
Wolves are another team that came up very fancied. They lost 2-0 to Leicester City. They got 1 point from two games. Leicester, with James Maddison getting on the score sheet, that's a guy that I know that you like him. We think he might be probably in the England picture by the end of the season, right? So Leicester are rolling. Wolves, bit of a tough start. Cardiff City also with a 0-0 against Newcastle this weekend. I can't remember a year with so much confidence around the newly promoted sides. And they're kind of having a ropey start. But you think that this is just a case of they're going to have to get up to speed?
Yeah, I think Wolves created so many chances in the first half against Leicester. Like, Jimenez looked really, really good. They hit the woodwork twice, I think. Moutinho looked good. So I don't think we should be too worried about them yet. Similarly, they were probably the better team against Everton in the game, which they drew 2-2 in the first weekend of the season. So I would still be I wouldn't necessarily change my predictions about Fulham or Wolves, even though neither of those teams have won a game yet. I think it will take them a while, but I do think eventually the quality they have in the team will tell.
The other results for Saturday, just to get them through, Everton 2, Southampton 1. Neat free kick from Everton in that game. I like a well-planned set-piece routine. Danny Ings, who you may remember a spirited debate about him last weekend, when we were trying to work out if he was better than Shane Long or not. But Ings scores for Charleston and Walcott both score. Everton win that 1-2-1. West Ham losing at home to Bournemouth is another bad result for West Ham, who do not seem able to shift the bad juju around them. But I wanted to get onto Sunday because, not just because we're going to talk about how great Man City were again, because we do that every week ever since we've started this podcast. But the way Sunday played out, whereas you woke up on Sunday morning and the Sunday papers were Jose Mourinho taking shots at Manchester City, saying that you can't buy class, saying that he deserved royalties for the amount he appeared in All or Nothing, the Manchester City documentary on Amazon Prime. It was, and I literally saw people describing it as vintage Mourinho on Sunday morning. And then Man City make Huddersfield look like a League Two side and trample all over them, and to be honest, that couldn't have looked like more of a mismatch. I don't think there's going to be as big a mismatch as that probably again this season. And until City play someone else out of form and beat them 8-0.
And yet they held City last year, which kind of made it all the worse for Mourinho, because it's kind of like a side that had held City and caused problems for City, that City had gone away, learned how to beat them and absolutely obliterated them. In comparison to Mourinho, who had a problem with Brighton, didn't get the result last season, and then goes to the same ground. And
that's it. And you're watching, as I say, the way Sunday plays out. So Mourinho thinks he's got a shot in. He's told this to the Sunday papers, right? So that's a deliberate thing to do. He knows that's going to be the back page of every Sunday paper when he says it. He's not a stupid guy. He's been in this game a long time. Then Man City put together one of the most cohesive, brilliant team performances you're ever likely to see. Completely outclass a lower table side. Then Man United go and lay an absolute egg against another mid-table. You know, Brighton are mid-table to low mid-table. What did they finish last year, like 15th? The optics for Mourinho are so bad, not just because of the way his team played, which we've discussed at length, not just because of the way that Guardiola's team played, which we've discussed at length for over a year now, but when you are him and you set up the comparison between yourself and City, it puts you in this position where you're getting doubly embarrassed, basically.
Yeah, the contrast couldn't be any clearer, really, could it, between whether it's City and United or Mourinho and Guardiola, or the style of football, the results. I mean, I don't really know how Mourinho solves this. Like, he can't give up. Like, he can't stop trying to fight City and can't stop trying to wind Pep up, because that's just who he is. But he must know that every time he draws a comparison is drawn between them, it looks worse on him.
There was a time when he was at Madrid when their huge differences, Guardiola and Mourinho, were a strength. I don't think you can look at anything about his Manchester United team anymore and say that it's a strength for the way they're playing. Like, you saw them against Brighton. Do you say Ed Woodward went into the changing room after?
Yes, I don't watch United enough to know if that's a regular thing that happens, but I assume it's not. Like, Ed Woodward came down and went into the dressing room on his own at the end of the game, and there was a screenshot of him in the stand at full time. He looked like he was fuming.
Sour.
Yeah, so I presume he's gone in there to have a word with the players rather than the manager. But I suppose one of the little interesting things that happened yesterday as well was there was a point where a Brighton player, Lewis Dunk, I think, was injured, and there was a pause in the game, and the Man United fans all, as one, sang Jose Mourinho, Jose Mourinho, and he gave them a wave, and it was like this was before Brighton started scoring.
Is it still 0-0?
Yeah,
okay, that's slightly different.
So yeah, you can take it away, but it was still that kind of show of support, I suppose, as he'd been in the papers that week. And
did they sing that at 3-1 down?
They did not sing that at 3-1 down. So yeah, I mean, I feel like he still got some of the support even after that result of the fans, but yeah, like you say, I think that was maybe an interesting little sign from Ed Woodward.
I've been watching All or Nothing. I'm only 3 episodes in. But like, probably the most striking and surprising thing to me about it is the intensity and passion and emotion of Guardiola on the training ground in the dressing room, which kind of doesn't fully come across in press conferences, to be honest, and how engaging he is with the players. And he's kind of running around, like, before matches, he's literally running around the dressing room screaming. He's so intense and worked up. And again, like, it's described in the, if you read the Marty Perenal books about his time at Bayern Munich, like, that sort of thing is described, but it's not the same as seeing it filmed. And I don't think it's put on for the cameras at all. I think it is just who he is.
How much do you think the players actually take in? There's so many good shots of Sané just standing there with, like, this baffled.
That's a good question. I was wondering exactly that. Like,
also language barrier.
How much of the detail he's trying to convey can they take on board? But clearly they must be able to, like, take on board the emotion. Yeah. And I wonder, like, when you see how grumpy and morose Mourinho is all the time, particularly, like, on the sidelines, before and after games, he can't be, like, I'm not saying that, like, passion is the difference, because of course it isn't, but he cannot have anything like the same impact on the players as Guardiola does.
There's a bit in that documentary, have you seen, where this was after the Chelsea game, and they come back into the dressing room, and all the players are shouting Kevin De Bruyne, like, and they're all, like, singing his name. And I just thought, you cannot imagine an equivalent situation in the Man United dressing room. And maybe that's because we don't have insight into it, but it seems such a lifetime
and
away.
Pep is part of the singing.
Yeah.
Pep is singing.
It's like clapping
as
away.
If you were any other player. Mm. And that is just so, I mean, it's just a snapshot. And again, we have an unbalanced picture, but it's literally unbelievable to me that anything equivalent could be happening at United.
I think we're going to have a longer discussion on All or Nothing at some point, because I've actually asked them if we could maybe get one of the producers on the podcast and just do a whole podcast about it, because I think it's an interesting topic for a number of reasons. I've seen a few columns written about it, about the kind of sanitization of stuff. And when you compare that, now you've got to remember this was a series done with American football teams, which is actually a rip-off of HBO's Hard Knocks, which is the original unbelievably good all access behind the scenes documentary, which I sent Luke the link to the other day, and he probably still hasn't watched.
Oh, I was busy.
Yeah, he was busy. I've watched 1.5 episodes of the City one, and I can already tell you that it's infinitely more controlled than the NFL equivalents. I think the club just have more power in this because the club are using it as a marketing thing rather than what it is. Whereas in the NFL, NFL teams don't have a choice. Like, whoever they pick, that's the team they're going to go and do, you see. So it's just behind the scenes, and they're fully ingrained with that team. They have the only editorial control they have, they can have a veto over certain information getting broadcast, but basically they don't have a choice. There's only certain teams every year that are eligible because it's teams that don't reach the playoffs, teams that don't have a new head coach, a couple of other things. This is not quite the same. This does feel more like a marketing exercise, but
it feels like the best and most expensive advert of all time.
Yeah, yeah. No, but it's tremendous. And you know, have you seen that wristband thing that Man City are offering now, which is essentially like it's a wristband like a Fitbit, and it vibrates with Man City news as you get it. Obviously, you know, imagine if their owners were involved in some sort of like financial scandal. Like, I'm sure that news isn't going to buzz through to your wrist.
Can I just pop on my well-worn Mourinho apologist cap again?
Go on.
Because, like, especially the second episode, but it is a running theme throughout the whole series, it is kind of obsessed with Mourinho. And the bits where it's kind of like, Pep Guardiola is known for his fluid, like, sexy football, but Jose Mourinho is the master of defensive.
They were talking about, you know, the derby. It's not like they were... That wasn't delivered as a drive-by. That was
no,
in the context
but
of explaining that game.
I was surprised to see kind of like clips of Mourinho talking and quite cleverly cut to kind of suggest that, yeah, you know, this is the dark, you know, defensive.
But you do have
master
to posit the two against each other, because and also that has been the story of football for the last decade.
Yeah, but you can understand why Mourinho would kind of rail against that. And I think his comments, even though they were inflammatory, they were, you know, he had a point.
No, yeah.
You should get over it.
Yeah, I mean, like,
I love you.
Like, shocker, Luke thinks Jose has a point. But, the, you know, the whole thing is, as I say, it feels to me the City have done a good job in terms of basically getting the best possible advert of yourselves out there. It worked so well because it was in a season where basically nothing went wrong. The Champions League exit is going to be the only thing of interest, because that's when you're going to see them dealing with adversity, really.
And another point I've remembered, which completely backs up what you were saying about, like, the control of information, is there was a scene where where Khaldun, Cheeky and Soriano are talking about signing a centre-back in the January transfer window. And obviously, like, the show is showing, oh, look at this. We're letting you into the meeting to hear them talk about transfers. And yet when they show the PowerPoint on the big screen of this meeting, like, the bit where it mentions centre-backs they might actually sign is blurred out.
Yeah.
So clearly, like, what is presented to you as being the genuine, the information you never thought you'd see is in fact self-mediated.
Yeah, of course. And so, you know, I think that the idea itself is obviously great. But it's easy for Joe, like, that's why I think it is easy for Jose to take shots, because in his eyes, it's like, well, this is all bollocks, because I know what happens behind the scenes in a football club. I only wish that Diego Torres, when he wrote that behind the scenes book of Mourinho at Real Madrid, had been able to film that as a documentary. The moment that Jose howled with tears when he found out Moyes was getting the gig to replace Ferguson, in particular, would have been a fun scene. Although probably a bit too distressing for Luke. I think that's it for this week. We've got Palace Liverpool tonight. We would love to preview it, but by the time you listen to this, it'll probably be over. So we can delete as appropriate Max Meyer's late winning goal as a substitute on debut. Beautiful moment. Or, you know, another 4-0 spanking for Liverpool, who looked ominously good last weekend. Until then, I guess the only thing left to do is to say thank you to Jack Pitbrook to my left.
Thank you, Ed.
Thank you to Luke to my right.
Thanks and hard luck, Jose.
And Lawrence Osler, who did a sterling job at Brighton versus Manchester United yesterday, containing Mourinho's anger. Mm. Lawrence, thank you for joining us. And I guess that's it until next week. Next Monday, I am on holiday. So probably, Jack, I guess you're hosting.
No, I'm not. I'm in Portugal.
Johnny might be hosting. We'll deal with that at a later date. But until then, have a good week. Be safe. And don't let Mourinho fuck around.
Most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances?
Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.